April 19th, 1995, Oklahoma City. It was a gorgeous day.
That day was bright.
I did not want to go to work.
Sunny, beautiful, birds chirping.
I was so hoping for some kind of non-tragic disease.
There wasn't really anything to complain about. It was beautiful.
It was a beautiful day.
A rare spring day where the wind wasn't blowing.
Skippity skip skipping. It was a great day.
That's how April 19th started. It was nice. Better, in fact, than most days, because it was such an ideal spring morning. From the Oklahoma Public Media Exchange, you're listening to That April Morning. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary. Workers were showing up to work, going about their regular routines, doing regular stuff.
I was preparing for a 9 o'clock appointment at the office.
We were about 30 minutes into an advanced cardiac life support course.
Timothy McVeigh had driven down the day before from Geary Lake up in Kansas.
I had gotten up early that morning, as I always did.
Just walked in, put the coffee on.
He then woke up that morning, got outside the yellow Ryder truck.
I was to take an ambulance to a group of homeschoolers in Moore.
Inside the cargo area of the Ryder truck was a 7,000-pound ammonium nitrate bomb that he had built with Terry Nichol.
We'd let him climb in the ambulance. We'd talk about the equipment and those types of things.
He heads out on the interstate, drives south to Oklahoma City.
I remember this particular student. Her name was Dana Cooper.
He lit the fuses like a block or two away.
She would be the director of the American Kids daycare in the Murrah building.
He comes up 6th Street, and he comes to a stoplight near the Regency Tower.
The additional benefit of this is that she was going to get to take her 2-year-old son with
her.
He's
waiting for the light to change. It's red.
It's really neat, fairly new facility.
And the cab is starting to fill up with smoke from the fuses.
There's nothing out of the ordinary about it.
He pulls up to the front doors of the Murrah building.
I was at my desk, as I was supposed to be, at 9 o'clock.
He parks the vehicle, and he notices a police car.
Park answering the telephones as they were turned on for the day.
He walks past the police car.
Sat down at the desk for a moment.
He starts to go down an alleyway. He breaks into a trot.
I was sitting right here at this intersection.
He passes a delivery man just about when the bomb went off.
And the blast happened.
Receive information regarding him.
About a third of the building has been blown away, and you can see just smoke and debris and fire on the ground downtown.
We heard this incredible rumble, and I heard's probably the wrong way to describe it. You didn't really hear it as much as felt it.
For just a split second, a tiny fraction of a second, everything went dark.
It was a very dull thump or thud. It wasn't a crack.
All of a sudden, we heard the boom.
You might call it a boom, but it really wasn't. It was more of a whump.
It was an incredible, deafening noise.
All the windows of this church, which I think is like St. Joseph's, all of the stained glass came just like pelting out.
I had the sensation as though I was falling very quickly and very just violently.
It felt like someone had reached out, put their hand on my chest and shoved me back.
The building shook so badly you couldn't stand.
I could feel the concussion of it.
I found out, you know, several minutes later that I had not fallen anywhere. I was still on the third floor.
The Journal Record building right there on the other side of the street from the Murrah building, all of a sudden everything caved in.
At 9 o'clock this morning, an explosion occurred at the Alfred Murrah Federal Building in downtown Oklahoma City. A blast that was felt for miles away. Cars all around the outside of the building. Charred.
I was assuming that I was dead at that point, and I just remember feeling sort of a sense of relief that it had been quick and painless. My name is Jason Williamson, and I work in the Modern Languages Department at the University of Oklahoma. At the time, I worked for the Federal Employees Credit Union, and the credit union was located on the third floor of the Murrah Building. Everything was just a complete void, just a blackness that I, you know, had never experienced before. It was a There was no sound. There was no smells that I remember. It was just this utter dark void. It did cross my mind that perhaps I had just been killed somehow. I did start moving, you know, a little bit, fingers and things like that, and I realized I was alive. And at some point, this extreme blackness, the extreme void, gave way just a little bit to where it became a heavy, hazy gray. And then the gray started to fade, and then it got steadily lighter and lighter. And where the light was coming from was now outside light, where there should have been two walls and a wall of windows between me and Fifth Street. It just wasn't there anymore. And now all this natural light was pouring in, and all the dust was finally settling. Finally broke me out of this state I was in was hearing a coworker of mine, Bobby Pervine, screaming, "What happened? What happened?" That woke me up. That snapped me back into reality. I got over to Bobby. I had to help pull her over her desk. There was no other way for her to go but over the desk. Another coworker of mine, he came to, and he joined us. And the three of us stood there looking now outside, which should never have been a possibility, just in shock, just not knowing what to do or what had happened. The parking lot across the street, the cars that were in that parking lot, many of them were on fire. We heard helicopters overhead. So between seeing the cars on fire, hearing the helicopters, and hearing all kinds of popping sounds it could have been breaking glass. I'm not sure what it was. But the combination of all of these factors made us think that maybe the city was under attack. And so we tiptoed around some debris and got to the hallway that then led us to a stairwell that got us out the south side of the building, which was not nearly as damaged as the north side where the truck had been parked.
Photographer Phil Monahan and I got down to the downtown area at about 10 after. You were seeing exactly what we saw as soon as we got there. This is taken at the 6th Street and Robinson area. They set up triage there. Literally hundreds of people being taken into ambulances, those who are critically injured. The others, like this lady.
Here's what I actually thought. God, I don't want to die. I don't want to die today. If it's all right with you, I'll die later. That's exactly what I thought.
I saw the large panes of glass of our front windows flexing and then shattering and then cascading down.
And I was within 2 feet, the floor broke away from me, and I was looking straight into the bomb pit.
He heads to his getaway car, the yellow Mercury Marquis.
And I was buried in rubble, hit on the head.
You saw a black cloud kind of boiling from behind the buildings.
When everything was still, I had all this stuff all over me.
He starts pulling away very slowly, not to cause any attention.
So I turned around to back up so I could park along the street, and that's when I saw the smoke coming from the other side of the Murrah building.
I got into the supervisor vehicle with Mike and one other medic, and we drove to the scene. We were there in probably less than 2 minutes.
The fire department felt like it was a natural gas explosion, and they requested all available personnel to report to the bomb site.
I said, there's been a massive explosion in downtown, and you need to get me on the air. So I think my first report was at 9:02:30.
Everyone at that point was working on the assumption that it was some sort of accident.
Maybe we'd had a gas explosion.
A gas main or something like that.
The first thing that I really noticed was the nitrates in the air.
The idea of a bomb just never occurred to me.
It smelled a lot like we were out at the firing range shooting our weapons.
No one had said the word bomb yet.
To me, it was a very similar odor, but it was much stronger. I immediately thought that this isn't natural gas.
If it wasn't a gas explosion, maybe we had a tornado. If it wasn't a tornado, maybe an airplane hit the building.
We started to recognize what looked like glitter in the black cloud.
I was not physically injured except for tiny shards of glass all in my skin.
It was sparkling. It became very apparent that it was, you know, it's typing paper.
You don't know what's happening because it was so sudden.
And I think that was the first time we realized there were desks and file cabinets and other things that accompany people. And I think that was our first realization that people were involved.
I got out without my shoes and it had blown the buttons off my top. And so walking down the hall, we were in the midst of things dangling from the ceiling, rubble in the hallway, smoke filling the place. So, of course, we thought it was our building.
I had no idea what I was in store for once I made it downtown.
And he had said to me that if you were in a helicopter loop and looked down, you would have seen all of these vehicles heading towards the Murrah building, and there would have been one little vehicle heading away, and that was me.
We came down and started in the rescue efforts.
The air was full of dust and dirt, small particulate matter.
I was able to kick a wall down between my office and get into the hall and then get people into the stairwell and get them out to the corner of 4th and Harvey, where all the ambulances were.
The original estimate was that there may be 300 or 400 people in the building. That meant that we had to expect possibly 300 or 400 injuries.
Everything started going into chaos.
If you've heard the phrase hell breaking loose, well, that's what that was.
Masses of people were milling about in the street.
People were running.
They weren't actually running in any one direction.
Everybody seemed to be covered in blood.
Everybody had come out of the surrounding buildings and weren't really sure what was going on.
People were coming out of the building.
It was just chaos, and I was in shock.
Once word got out that it was the Murrah building, all the parents started running.
He got on the interstate and was heading north up to Noble County, and he did not have a license plate.
Task of searching for bodies and the hopeful task of trying to find some more survivors of today's deadly blast in downtown Oklahoma City continues at this hour.
If you can imagine the Saturday evening at the State Fair in front of the cinnamon roll booth, take that crowd of people, get them all afraid, very noisy and very mobile, and park two ambulances in the middle of it with a dozen medics trying to take care of people, you've got a real good idea of what it looked like.
When you see people who are responding to emergencies being excited about something, you know that this is not normal.
I went in and out of the building. I didn't observe any live victims. Everyone that I dealt with was deceased.
We transported 110 total patients by 10:05 that morning.
It's not going to be a normal situation.
Lots of cuts. There were bruises.
My injuries were lacerations.
Very few burns. In fact, there was no real fire at the explosion site.
We started seeing people coming back towards the dealership, and they were bloodied.
My head injuries were, I had a light fixture that came down, cut my ear in half, tore open my cheek.
We had some crushing injuries, and unfortunately we had a couple of falls. People just trying to get away or get out.
Who would have ever thought something like that would happen in Oklahoma City?
I remember there were several people, who were hurt. They kind of looked like tornado victims.
The back was full of glass from the window.
The front half of their shirts would look really normal, and then there would be nothing. So the only thing holding their shirts on would be like a collar.
You really just don't know what to think.
If you measured things from end to end, I had close to 4 feet worth of stitches.
Lots of cuts, bruises, glass, those kinds of things.
Entranced, because you couldn't get away from the TV. You just wanted to see what was going on.
When I saw the limos coming in and the big satellite trucks, I mean, like, major satellite, I was like, oh, this is a really big story. I mean, this is like, big.
Once they are triaged and it's decided whether they are very minor injuries that really don't even need treatment, minor injuries that need treatment that can wait, major injuries that need to be treated immediately, or unfortunately those patients that are either expired or going to expire no matter what you do. And in a disaster situation, that's a very real category. Bill Kenny, I was the training coordinator for the Emergency Medical Services Authority, EMSA. One of the rescuers brought me an infant that had injuries that were totally incompatible with life. There was not a prayer that a miracle could save it. In a disaster situation, you have to accept those things. I took the child, handed it to one of our people working in the treatment area, one of our female medics, and said, would you place this child in the ambulance that we had designated as a morgue for children. She advised me that, you know, the baby still appeared to be breathing, and I told her that it was simply an agonal response, that there was no life there, and another medic, a senior paramedic on the scene, confirmed that to her. She relayed to me that she didn't feel like she could just lay the baby down, and so I let her get in the back of the ambulance, closed the door, gave her some privacy, and she held the baby and rocked it until the respirations ceased. I'm very, very moved by that instinct of her not being able to lay that baby down to die by itself. And I think that's the kind of bravery that we saw in all of our medics, and for that matter, all of the responders that morning. If I allow five medics to take care of five patients that we all know aren't going to survive, especially a patient like this that we can look at and say there's nothing to survive, there are brain injuries incompatible with life, those five medics could be helping somebody else that, if we assign them to that black tag patient, another patient may die that could have been saved.
Everything was brought to a screeching standstill when bomb-sniffing dogs alerted the authorities that there were further explosive devices inside the building. We've had varying reports of how many there were, perhaps two, perhaps three. We do know that they have defused several of them.
Someone actually came out of the building announcing that there was a second bomb.
They called to evacuate the area because they felt they had found another device.
There was a very real threat. We evacuated.
When they were trying to make everyone get back because they thought they had another device in the building.
We actually had a couple of medics refuse to leave because they were with a patient.
And she looked up at me at that point and said, "Please don't leave me." I said, "I'm not going anywhere."
They kept having kind of false reports that there were other devices, and they would push back the perimeter, and then people would come back in to help.
It was later found that the second bomb or second device was actually a training device.
There's just a lot of chaos.
It wasn't anything dangerous, but it certainly scared everybody at the time.
My name is Lou Michel. I'm a journalist and an author. American Terrorist, Timothy McVeigh and the Oklahoma City Bombing. I wrote it with Dan Herbeck. When Charlie Hanger had stopped him, it was because he didn't have a license tag on the back of the vehicle.
So I'm going up the interstate and pass, actually come up behind this old yellow Mercury. I see that there's no tag on the car.
He said that was by design. He was ready to get caught because he claimed his goal was to be essentially a martyr.
I'm actually ahead of him. I have to slow down, get back behind him, turn on my emergency lights, and he stops. And so I open my car door, stand behind my door, and I'm yelling for the driver to get out of the car.
McVeigh, when he looked in the rearview mirror, he realized that he could easily have killed the trooper.
I think he was waiting for me to step out from behind my car so he could probably get a shot at me, but I never gave him that opportunity.
But he said to himself, "No, I'm not going to do that because he's not a federal agent."
He just steps out finally, and he comes walking toward me. I step out from around my car door and approach him. We meet somewhere between our two cars, and I tell him, "The reason I stopped you is because you're not displaying a tag. No tag."
You know, arrested, you know, approximately 70 minutes after the bombing.
I secured the car, locked it up, took him to the Noble County Jail.
Southwest Medical Center, they have a 2.5-year-old little girl, fair skin, red hair, and blue eyes. She is in stable condition right now, but they need to take her to surgery. They don't know who she is. They don't know who her parents are.
Kevin McCullough. And I'm a resident of Oklahoma City. And at the time of the Murrah bombing, April 19th, 1995, I was an Oklahoma City police officer, and I was also an EMT for IMSA. I'd really seen the worst of what could happen in a career that day, but also you see the best in people. You see people off the street, pull off the highway, rush into the building, try to help carry victims, help carry bodies, help direct traffic. So you see the worst of what men can do, but you see also what the best people have in them. So I describe April 19th, 1995 as one of the worst things that's ever happened to me in my life, but also one of the best things, because as I was down here working in the rescue efforts with the bombing, unbeknownst to me, my wife was in the hospital giving birth to my youngest son, Jordan. That was about 11:40 that morning. My family tried to reach me, and of course our pagers weren't working down here. Our cell phones weren't working down here. That was something that was, again, something very horrific happened that day, but in my life, also something very special happened that day. And it's amazing, I've now been involved in law enforcement for over 30 years, and that's the only child of mine out of four that I've missed their birth. I experienced the full gamut of emotions that day, I believe. When I got home, I expected someone to be there, and they were at the hospital, including my parents and my sisters, and so I just immediately picked myself up and drove to the hospital and got to see, had a nice visit with my wife, and the nurses were very nice and let me see my newborn son, Jordan. I can tell you now, looking back, that I needed that. At the end of a day like that, when you just don't know what to do, you just don't know what to think, you're at your wit's end, and you're both physically and mentally exhausted. That's where I was at that time, and I needed that. That's what I needed.
I mean, this was a place that a lot of people went in every day. And I think that's why it was so difficult for people to kind of get their heads around that we were all kind of possible targets in this very well-planned, executed mission, really, in his eyes.
I'm Neil Conan. We want to take a moment to bring you all up to date on the situation in Oklahoma City. At around 9 o'clock this morning, a bomb apparently was detonated inside the Alfred Murrah Federal Building. Hundreds have been injured. Joining us now from Oklahoma City and member station KGOU is Steve Carmody. Steve, what can you tell us is happening now? What's the scene look like there?
Well, right now, they're in the cleanup mode around the facility, but the local fire department is working to try to get some people who are still in the federal building out of it. When the explosion occurred, it took off basically the north face of the building and has trapped some people on the southern side of the building, and they are going up with cherry pickers and taking them out. It's a delicate operation because, as you would probably imagine, many of these people are injured, many seriously injured, and so they're going to have to be very delicate.
I know the situation there is still very confused. What are the official numbers that you have on those killed and those injured?
At this point, I've been told by official sources that there are 8 dead. six of them children. The building housed a daycare center for federal workers' children.
We're hearing reports that this was a car bomb. Any confirmation of that?
Nothing official, but everything is pointing that way.
And we're also hearing reports that there was a second device in the building that was defused.
Has claimed this little girl. She is in fair condition, which is not in very good condition. They need to do surgery on her. She is 2.5 years old with red hair, blue eyes, and very fair skin.
Lisa Seelert. I teach. I'm a full-time professor here at the University of Central Oklahoma. At the time, I was a full-time kindergarten teacher, and I taught as an adjunct professor in early childhood education for UCO. But I remember this particular student. Her name was Dana Cooper, and she would come in and give us a running report on the fact that she had applied to be a daycare director in a facility down in Oklahoma City. She did indeed get the job, and she would be the director of American Kids Daycare in the Murrah Building, and we learned more. She really started to tell us, this is the federal building downtown, it's really neat. Fairly new facility. The additional benefit of this is that she was going to get to take her 2-year-old son with her. So I took Ro call just to kind of see who all came, and we noticed Dana wasn't there, and we started talking. Now, where did she work? You know, she was downtown. And then little by little our memories came back that, yeah, she was in the federal building. And how many federal buildings? And you know how you just search your brain to come up with an alternative. And we, before the evening was over, we knew in our hearts that she had been there. And we didn't find out until the very next day that indeed she was on the list. Not only Dana, but her young son, Anthony, was lost in the bombing as well.
Earlier this afternoon, President Clinton declared Oklahoma City a site of national emergency. I asked Mayor Ron Norick exactly what that meant. At this point, he says he is unsure as to what the classification means, but he is grateful for the assistance of the president in sending additional FBI units along with other federal agents to try to determine.
I remember my mom picking me up from kindergarten and just being different.
I got assigned to go down to where all the families were gathering.
Talking about images that stand out in your mind, I mean, I think one that everybody knows is the fireman holding the child.
They were making the public identifications, and I was there for about 3 minutes, and I called and I said, I can't be here. I can't cover this part of it.
Those kids were my age. You know, those kids that were there were the same age as me or younger, and that's kind of hard for a 5-6-year-old to see.
I said, I will not do an objective reporting job, because now when you see the aftermath of how, not just the injured, but how it is changing.
It was just like having a picture of a perfectly beautiful spring day and somebody just ripping the center out of it into this big dark abyss.
You know, that's just one of those moments that you kind of remember, is there are bad people in the world and you're not immune to it regardless of your age.
We all kind of fell off a cliff together that morning.
Bombing happened on April 19th, a Wednesday, and on Friday, Timothy McVeigh was taken into custody by federal agents. For 3 days, he was in a cell at the Noble County Jail. about 75 miles north of Oklahoma City. Tracing the vehicle identification number that was embossed on one of the Ryder truck's axles, they were able to trace it back to up in Kansas where he had rented the vehicle. And one step led to another. And then they ran his name through a national search and saw that he had been arrested by the Oklahoma State Police. Of course, they called up the Noble County Sheriff's Office and said, please keep a hold on that prisoner.
You have lost too much, but you have not lost everything. And you have certainly not lost America. For we will stand with you for as many tomorrows as it takes.
You remember driving around on the highway in the days after?
And seeing row upon row and car upon car with their headlights on in the middle of the day.
Everybody in Oklahoma City had their headlights on.
2 weeks following, 3 weeks following.
I am thinking about you as victims.
That was something that wordlessly communicated, we're all in this together.
I'm thinking about you, rescue workers.
So it was an intentional symbol of togetherness and solidarity, of mourning and of hope.
And I think that a lot of people, you know, maybe experienced a sense of community in Oklahoma City that they hadn't experienced before.
It brought the city together. We were all Oklahomans, Okies.
Survivor as opposed to victim. And that always seems to be important to me. I don't really like to be called a victim. I like to be called a survivor. Susan Erbach, I'm a regional director for the Small Business Development Center at the University of Central Oklahoma. My injuries were lacerations. If you measured things from end to end, I had close to 4 feet worth of stitches. I needed a little bit of care after the hospital, so I went home with a friend who, he was a doctor and she was a nurse, and they could kind of help me with all the wounds because I sort of, you know, it was not good for a while. And then after my parents came down and they stayed with me too, and they left, and then I went to St. Gregory's, to the monastery there, and I slept for 3 days. That's all I did. So I went to be with the monks in the prayers and just kind of being in a sanctuary, if you were. And I think that was probably one of the absolute best things to have done, to have just said, you need to remove yourself and get yourself very centered. And for me, to be very centered is centered around my faith. I found great benefit in being in a bomb-damaged church. And I found that as we dealt with what does it mean to be in a building that's all of a sudden, you know, you can't use? How does a community of faith deal with that? I think I'm a lot deeper. For me, part of my healing process, because it throws everything, in a sense, open for the unanswerable, what I call the unanswerable questions of life. You know, why me? Why not me? Why does someone do this? What is, you know, what is a senseless act? You try to wrap your arms around that or your head around that, and no matter what, it's still senseless, okay? Trauma, justice, there are so many major kinds of issues that for me, one of the things that it did was to cause me to sit down and really ponder many, 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 many different kinds of things. And I think the greatest takeaway of the bombing is, you know what? Life is really short. Life is temporary. And you know, the things that matter are love. For the people that I knew, at least, and who are still, say, working downtown, for example, I mean, I always know that that's a connection. It's like being a war buddy, basically. is that you know, no matter what happens, there's something that's a very deep connector to you. And it's just, of course, it's absolutely amazing because downtown is so different from 20 years ago. Destruction, evil, it comes in this huge, huge, big, dramatic incident like the bombing. But healing doesn't come that way. Healing comes slowly. It comes very gently. Think more not of the F5 tornado, but the spring shower.
Okay, it's Jennifer Lindsay McClintock. I don't recall the exact second that I felt the need to stand up and say I'm going to volunteer. The public was giving. We had such a generous public, and the media would put out, you know, we need towels, we need socks, we need t-shirts, we need booties for the dogs. I was stationed here at the old post office. They felt the need to have supplies closer to the building site. My job then became to not only intake all of these supplies and sort them, but also to serve as hospitality for many of the search and urban rescue specialty teams that were coming in from across the country. There were teams from Virginia, from California, from Florida, from Seattle, Washington. Many of them had canine units. We really were there for support, and that was our role. It was so small and minuscule in comparison to the contributions of so many other people.
My injuries healed. I was lucky they weren't permanent.
This was an important day in my life and an impactful day in my life, and it probably changed me.
I didn't lose family members in the bombing. We're very, very close, long-time friends.
I know it changed me, but it wasn't about me.
And that enabled me to come to terms with it and to make my peace. It wasn't always easy.
The people who, every time they go to a wedding, they think, I'm never going to go to my daughter's wedding because she died in the Oklahoma City bombing.
And I don't think it's ended yet for so many people who lost family members. That's something that they're still dealing with.
You know, those are the people who have to carry that.
My name is Angela Leal, and I'm an assistant director in the financial aid office at Oklahoma City Community College. I actually met my husband at church on the one-year anniversary of the bombing in 1996. There was a worship night at OU, and so me and another friend were attending, and so I had just met him 4 or 5 weeks before, so I just invited him to go with me, and so our first date was actually on the one-year anniversary of the bombing. And so that started our relationship. We dated for a few months, got engaged in August of 1996. And as we were choosing a wedding day, April just ended up being the month that worked best. And so as we got to looking at it, we decided that April 19th was actually a good day to plan our wedding. A lot of people say, why would you want to choose that day to get married? And isn't that just a horrible day? Why would you want to do that? And for us, that day is a good day. And, you know, when we talk to people about it, we just say, you know, a lot of horrible things happen that day, but there are still a lot of good things that happen in the world. And for us, it's a good day to remember that day. And it's a good way to offer hope that even though this horrible thing happened, there's still hope. There's still love in the world. There are still good things that happen in the world. And for us, it's a good way to remember something positive that has happened on that day.
I'm Chad Huntington. I'm the general manager of Water Taxi on the Bricktown Canal in Oklahoma City. In 1995, I was the inventory manager for Fred Jones Ford, which was an automobile dealership downtown. We were coming out of the depths of the oil bust, and times were not great in Oklahoma City already. And I think that we developed in that moment an understanding that we can pull ourselves up from anything, pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. And that's what Oklahoma City does. It's not the first time Oklahoma City's faced adversity. And it's happened since. I mean, we've had natural disasters and other things that have been very trying, but Oklahoma City always bounces back and is very resilient. And I think, you know, that's our story. And the bombing illustrated that, and the timing of it ended up coinciding with efforts that were already underway. And so, yeah, I think the bombing was hugely important in a lot of the effort that we gave to downtown. But I think that the reasons were that we weren't going to allow that to be the final chapter for downtown.
McVeigh was angry at the federal government, one, because he thought that the Clinton administration was going to limit gun ownership. Two, he was very upset over Ruby Ridge. And three, Waco. You know, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And I think Terry Nichols was more of a follower than a leader. But, you know, he shared the same ardent anti-government beliefs as Tim McVeigh.
My name is Jason Williamson. At the time, I worked for the Federal Employees Credit Union, and the credit union was located on the third floor of the Murrah Building. Those of us who were there for the trial, for the family members and survivors, would generally meet every evening at the hotel restaurant just to have each other, just to and also to sort of make sense of what we had heard and seen that day. A brother and sister, they told me that they couldn't imagine what it was like to be me. They couldn't imagine what I had gone through. And they, it turns out they had lost their parents in the blast. You know, it was just incredible for me to hear this, that they were saying that they couldn't imagine what suffering I had gone through, when in fact I told them, you know, I can't imagine what you went through, because my injuries healed. I was lucky. They weren't permanent, and I didn't lose any family members. And I just cannot comprehend what it would have been like to lose a family member in a manner like this. It was an extremely strange feeling to be sitting just a few feet away from this man who caused so much pain and devastation, and who also, you know, who tried to murder me, you know, who did murder 168 other people. And it was, it was just a whole range of emotions going through my head as I would stare at him for that every day for that 1 week at the trial.
He never apologized. He did send a half-hearted apology to Dan and I about 6 weeks before he was to be executed. And essentially it was, I'm sorry so many people had to die, but the government made me do it. That's what it amounted to. He was constantly writing me letters. He was saying, well, why don't we just publicize my execution? Why don't we have it on, you know, cable television, and the government can charge a fee for people to watch it? You know, he was making a mockery of the whole system.
When the verdict had been finalized with McVeigh, and I received this letter, dear victims, survivors, and family members, and that was to advise that plans had been announced for participation in the viewing of the execution of Timothy McVeigh. I just can't imagine viewing an execution. You know, it's watching a human being put to even someone like this, who tried to murder me and who did murder 168 other people, viewing it just as something I cannot imagine taking part in.
Okay, my name is Tori Butzer.
I'm Hans E. Butzer, co-designer.
I'm a co-designer.
Oklahoma City National Memorial.
We're supposed to somehow remember a violent act that took place here, but we want all the visitors who come here to leave with a sense of peace. And so it was this kind of challenging assignment to do both of those things simultaneously. We also wanted to recognize the people who survived, and we also wanted to recognize the people who helped, because I think that is such an invaluable part of the story. Is, you know, there's this bad thing that took place here, but what happened afterwards was so exponentially wonderful.
She's so much the people person, read about all of the victims and really started to understand their own stories. You know, from there, gained an insight into the kind of the deep sense of emotional loss, as well as recognizing that while this is a civic memorial, it is you know, to become a national memorial, it's still about the loss of 168 individuals.
Right off the bat, we're remembering those who were killed. So we're recalling that violence, right? So we're not forgetting the violence, but we're ultimately trying to create a place where people can find some sense of comfort and peace and leave here with taking that with them and leaving the anger behind. I think that's, you know, what we felt like was our charge, and that's very much what we tried to do. We've always said the chair is, it seems like such a simple element that so many people can relate to, but I had a different take on it. The other day I was reading our youngest daughter a story, and it was a picture book, and it was about this little girl who just loved her grandfather, and they did all kinds of things together. And then she went into the room one day, and it said the chair was empty. And that implied to the readers of that story that the grandfather had died, and she was very sad. And so this image of this empty chair was really, you know, there was very few words needed to kind of explain the bigger context of what had just happened.
One of the things that Tori and I felt very strongly about from the beginning was that we wanted this place to be designed in such a way that it really becomes integrated into the fabric of the city, and that it evolves into being not just a memorial but also a public space, a civic space, you know, a green space, a park, and we wanted it to have a certain formality on the one hand, but on the other hand, still be accessible enough to where people could just simply move through.
But it was just to provide this as a starting point to move forward and to get beyond the violence and to move forward from there in a more hopeful way.
It's like a quiet plea to visitors, you know, to learn from this and see how you can rededicate every day to doing one little thing to make this a better world. And to see what can you do to help prevent things like this from happening. And the easiest way to do it is to instill a greater sense of goodness in others and to lead by example.
And to be able to leave the violence behind and your anger behind.
Obviously, the 901 is the tower on the east, the moment before the bombing, and the 903 tower to the west. And what took place in between is symbolic. The rows of chairs of those that were killed. And then on the west side of where we're standing are state trees, symbolizing the help that came from firemen and all kinds of law enforcement help.
You know, I got here early today and I was just overwhelmed. I wasn't sure how I was going to handle this. After the bombing, I would only come to the site when I was assigned to by the police department. When they dedicated the memorial, when they would have dignitaries come in, when we would have the fifth year, the 10 year, I would come down here when I was assigned to. Once every two or three years, I'm asked to come down and speak with a group of visitors at the museum. And it's very difficult for me to do, but I still do it because I want people to know the good and the bad.
We're at the survivor tree.
It itself is a survivor.
It's an American elm tree.
And it comes back green every spring, just like Oklahoma does.
It equates to the resilience of the people in Oklahoma.
That tree was there when the bomb blast occurred.
It was almost taken down because it was pretty damaged and charred. And
it was scarred by the explosion, and it's still standing there.
People started to rally around this tree.
We gather the seeds. We give these trees away.
I've been very, very privileged to help plant several seedlings off that tree.
It's another symbol of our spirit, our goodness.
So it's quite a symbol for us.
Our desire to do the right thing.
It all of a sudden attained importance.
Not dwell on the evil and the negative that maybe the people behind this would want us to dwell on. So we refuse to do that. I fully believe that children got extra hugs many days after that. It's very difficult for those of us, for many of the us that responded down here on that day. It's difficult to talk about. It's difficult to visit this place. But when we do, it's with respect. It's wanting to maintain the dignity and realizing that we won't forget. It doesn't get easy, but maybe it gets easier a little bit with time.
The Oklahoma City bombing on April 19, 1995, killed 168 people and injured hundreds more. Timothy McVeigh was found guilty and sentenced to death. He was executed in 2001. His conspirator, Terry Nichols, is serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole. We'd like to thank all of the survivors, first responders, and others in Oklahoma City who shared their stories with us. This program was produced by KGOU in Norman, KOSU in Stillwater, and the Oklahoma Public Media Exchange. Special thanks go to Kate Carlton Greer, Michael Cross, Brian Hardzinski, Rachel Hubbard, Jim Johnson, Logan Layden, Ryan LaCroix, and Joe Wirtz. I'm Jacob McClelland. Thanks for listening.